Hey guys, how's it going? Can you believe it's that time again? Lucky you. You get to talk again to me. Well, listen. Let's see. Now is the time for me to write up today's blog entry that I should have done 10 minutes ago. Today's show, Mitch Prothero. 12 to 2 Eastern. Not that he'll be on the whole time. And give a little triple click and a copy. And how are you guys, man? You like blog entries? I'm writing one. And then, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to copy and I'm going to paste it into Twitter and at liberty.me. In case you want to forward those links on to your pals. I mean, assuming that you have pals or links. Probably do. Alright, am I logged in here? Yeah, there you go. Hey, liberty.me people, check it out. I'm posting a link. Today I'm going to be talking with a reporter who I think, I'm not certain actually, but I think is back in Erbil. Who is in Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan. I don't know if the other parts of Kurdistan have their own capitals or not. I guess they do. But Erbil is the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. It's a region bisected by five or six states, you understand? And anyway, so he's keeping track of the Iraq War 3 now, for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. And by the way, thanks to McClatchy DC, we were able to arrange a cool deal at antiwar.com where if you click a link to a McClatchy story from antiwar.com, they'll let you around the paywall there. So, yeah, I asked James Asher for that, and they very graciously said sure. So, you know, you have to admit, even Roy Gutman, who has crazy, weird neocon neurons in his brain, he's still a nice guy, and he's still an honest guy, even though sometimes he's way off about stuff, but I don't know. I like him. He seems like he means well, and he sometimes does really great reporting, like about civilian casualties in Syria or American Saudis clamped down in Bahrain back in 2011 and 12. Remember that? Well, it's still going on, but he had great reporting about that. Anyway, and then there's Landay and Prothero, and unfortunately no longer Nancy Youssef. She's at the Daily Beast now. But anyway, he got some pretty goddamn good reporters over there. Our friend David Enders used to write for him, too. Anyway, so Prothero, yeah, he's covering Iraq War 3 for McClatchy. He's going to be on, and I got a lot to talk with him about in only half an hour. You know, I think I might try to blow through the middle break rather than keep him overtime because I know he's got to go. But I might try to just go through that middle break there because I got to ask him so many different things about stuff. So many different questions about things. All right, anyway, so moving on here real quick. I think I got all my tweets out and what have you, and this and that. Retweet me, for Christ's sake. Oh, yeah, did I say I'm at scotthorton.org? Scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there, my whole show archives, too. But all the interviews, cut them out and post them separate. More than 3,700 of them now, going back to 2003. That's a lot of interviews of people, don't you think? I mean, granted, most of them are with Gareth Porter and Phil Giraldi and Eric Margulies. No, not most of them. 3,700 interviews going back to 2003. And join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Got a good group of people in there. Hey, guys, how's things? Oh, Sneaker's in there. Yeah. Hey, Sneaker. And then also follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Give me a goddamn retweet, would you? Retweet me. I'm twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Gave up Facebook more than a year ago now. Feel great about it. Do not miss Facebook. All right. Man, so, yeah, B.B. King. Here, I'm going to play your song. B.B. King died. I screwed that up and cut the first note off of that thing, didn't I? Sorry, man. This is a VLC player's fault, too, but mostly mine. Yeah, so B.B. King died of old age. This morning or last night or something. Yeah, he was great. So here's him from a Necessian point of view, singing the blues about our paper money. Oh, man. That goddamn flash player. Oh, no. It's a fire. Nah, I bet it was a flash player. Cost of living, man, it keeps going up. Uh-huh. Yes. Alright, so that's some B.B. King complaining about paper money. And I know you're saying, but TV says that the inflation rate is low. And I say, really, what do the prices on the shelves at the store tell you? You haven't noticed? Thank goodness fuel prices are down, but down to 215? Whoa, were they high for that to be down 215. And of course, most of the inflation, instead of coming in widespread price inflation, CPI type inflation across the board, which is a completely manipulated figure anyway, but I mean that kind of widespread price inflation mostly doesn't happen like that. It mostly happens in certain bubbles in certain markets, you understand. And so, got a housing bubble again. Got a stock market bubble. They say we got a bond bubble, although I don't really understand enough about that to really talk about it. But anyway, I think what they mean is overall bad bets on the price of, on the actual value of dollars at this point. Anyway, yeah. We'll be back after this with bad news, and then Mitch Prothro.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
You know, I keep forgetting to talk with Ian about that. I guess I got so used to hearing it that way, it doesn't sound strange to me anymore. But just now, it occurred to me that, yeah, that sounds strange to start it right there, don't you think? Get a different version of that. What would Ozzy say? All right. Anyway, so yeah, it's my show. Hey, there's a new way to help support the show other than shopping at Amazon by way of my website, other than patronizing all of my wonderful sponsors, other than donating single donations or monthly subscription donations by way of PayPal or Google Wallet. There's another newer, more better? No, but just as good way to help support the show. It's Patreon, which I guess is mostly created for artists, but hey, who says I'm not an artist? It's pretty close to kind of something like that, anyway. But they, you know, podcasting is one of their things here, so I thought, well, how about set it up where people can sign up to donate $1 or whatever other amount per interview, if you want to think of it that way, how much these interviews are worth to you, and do it on a per interview basis. And then that helps incentivize me to do a better job making sure I always have three guests every day. if that's what you want to hear. So check me out at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow if you want to figure out how to support the show. And I don't know what it takes to get on the front page of Patreon or whatever, where Patreon community folk can learn about it. I think I'm kind of lost in a dark corner of the Patreon web. I need to work on that a little bit. Anyway, so there's that. And then the Kickstarter. Did I mention everybody donated the Kickstarter? Obviously, we had a problem with the server and all that, but we're getting back to work on that. And the project is kind of multifaceted. First of all, we got to make sure all the interviews that are posted at antiwar.com from 2007 are also at scotthorton.org. Now, 99.9% of them are, or something like that, but I think there may have been a couple that got lost and, you know, omitted between two Gareth Porters when they got transferred over, you know? Interviewed them on Monday and on Thursday, and then the interviewees that were there on Tuesday and Wednesday didn't get transferred over because we started on you probably understand what I mean. Anyway. So we got to make sure that's done. And we got to make sure all of them MP3s work. Every single one of them. And then we got to get them all uploaded to YouTube. And now, of course, there's a wrinkle, which is the guy that made the awesome intro mashup musical soundbite thingy at the beginning of the show now. He also, I guess, has the ability to go back and take some of these very poor quality early interviews and make them a little bit less bad. I mean, I don't think I'm not, you know, saying he promised magic or anything. But I think he's going to be able to make them sound quite a bit better anyway. The funny thing was, see, back then, say 2003 or 4, I couldn't get it through my head. I didn't know about all this computer stuff, you know, I don't know. So I couldn't figure out how in Cool Edit Pro to save things as like maybe 16-bit this or that, you know. So I was saving everything as these huge files. So my buddy Dan, who had donated the server space, he's like, look, man, this is ridiculous here. Let me fix this. And he then went and cut them all down to 8K. And like, you know, I had them at like 32K, 256 stereo or whatever. For back then, remember in 2003, you know, server space and bandwidth were a lot more expensive. And so I was saving everything at way too high quality, but then so to fix it, Dan cut them all way down to 8K, and then I think most of my archives got written over by the lower quality versions. Oy. Anyway, so got a guy who's going to try to fix up some of those older ones and make them sound a little bit less horrible. I mean, some of them are really bad. I didn't even really realize. Go back. Oh, man. But he's going to try to fix them up a little bit, so that might put off the YouTube upload, the final stage of the project, a little bit longer. But it'll be worth it, right? We don't want to have those first few years worth just so horrible that nobody could stand to hear it, especially, you know, they're going to degrade in quality once they're uploaded to YouTube anyway, probably a little bit, right? So, they got to convert them to their own sound file system and whatever. All right, anyway, so that's all that stuff. And then, man, I'm sorry, Shea Machine Riley. What a cool name, Shea Machine. I said his name wrong the other day, and then I went and looked it up in the email how to say it. Oh, yeah, Shea Machine, that's right, he told me, pronounce it like Shea Machine. And then here I was calling him C. Musin or some crap, the poor guy. And then yesterday I was going to correct myself. That was the day before yesterday I got it all wrong. And then... and found the right answer after the show. And then yesterday I completely forgot to fix it. And then so, yeah. Here's the fix. Thank you for supporting the Kickstarter, Shea Machine Riley. For everybody else whose name I screwed up, I'm very sorry. Just send me a tweet mocking my stupidity and explaining how better to say it, and I'll say it to you too. Thanks very much. Okay. And then, man, so we're almost out of time for this segment, so I don't really want to get into the Nakba until next hour. We're going to talk about a little bit of important history. It's the history of the Palestinian Nakba today. The Iran bill, we got important news on the Iran bill. Oh, and Patriot Act, too. Also, I mean, not Patriot Act, too. That's an old thing. And then... oh, yeah, now we got to talk about the Republicans and Iraq War II as well. That'll be all in the second hour. But now let me mention Mark Ames, old friend of the show back when the Republicans were in power. He was all right. And then I just have grown to have such distaste for his writing and even his person since then. Attacking every libertarian is the... libertarianism is the worst part of the right when we're not even the right in the friggin' first place. But then making it seem like that's what's destroying America is libertarianism? What in the world? And also just completely ridiculous guilt by associations and completely dishonest readings of everyone's motives and just ridiculous nonsense. It's ridiculous. For Christ's sake, Ames, get it together, man. Years of this. The whole entire Obama era of this. And I could go on, but I won't. But I will say this. You know what? I told Eric, go ahead and run a thing by Mark Ames on antiwar.com today because it's about Seymour Hersh. And it's actually a really well-done little thing there about how all of the liberals and all the, you know, the mainstream liberals... the acceptable Democratic Party writer types, and the Washington Post and the New York Times and the rest. Oh, no, it was for the Times, but everybody else. They all attacked Hersh and went after Hersh in the exact same way they're doing now. Back in, I think it was 1970, he says. I don't have it in front of me, sorry. Very early 70s anyway, 70, 71, something like that, when Hersh broke the story of the CIA's Operation Chaos. Infiltrating the American anti-war movement. And they all attacked him and said it was bogus and that his sources weren't reliable and whatever, whatever. And then eventually William Colby, the director of Central Intelligence, confirmed it under oath in front of the U.S. Congress. So they all had to shut their mouths but not apologize, of course. Same story 45 years later. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, check it out. I got Mitch Prothro back on the line here. He's reporting for McClatchy, D.C. out of Erbil in Kurdistan. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Mitch?
I'm doing okay. It's been sort of a crazy day here in Iraq.
I can imagine. All the news says that Ramadi is being taken over completely now by the Islamic State today. Is that correct?
Basically, most of Ramadi has been overrun. It started late last night with a sort of devilishly brilliant operation involving giant armored bulldozers and suicide bombers. And at this stage, there's a thing called the Anbar Operations Center, which is basically the provincial headquarters for the military. That appears to be holding out, but is deeply besieged. And I can no longer get through to anybody on the phone who's inside it. Other than that, it looks like more or less a government route in the provincial capital of Al-Anbar.
Wow. And now, so if I understood it right, I'm sure there's probably at least a real good chance you saw David Ender's video report for Vice magazine out of Ramadi a couple of few weeks ago. And my impression from that was that basically, am I right, the city's divided in half by the river and half was still under the control of the government at that point. And so now they've come across the bridge and taken the rest of the city. Is that basically it?
Yeah, essentially, they didn't come via the river, but they basically last night, several armored bulldozers suddenly pulled up to the front lines and started moving blast walls out of the way and clearing roadblocks. And they were doing this basically in order to allow in six suicide car bombers who then smashed into the defenses of the town, of the provincial council headquarters buildings. In a place like Ramadi, there's a large area in the center of the city that would be considered the government compound where the different ministries would be based, and that had been holding out. And those suicide bombers basically decimated their defenses, and there's been nonstop fighting ever since. And what I've been last I've heard, and I haven't been able to get a report out of Ramadi now for a couple hours, was that the elite unit that had been holding out, it's called the Golden Brigade, had withdrawn to a stadium where they were hoping to be evacuated. But for the most part, Ramadi looks like it's rapidly collapsing if it hasn't completely already.
Mm-hmm. And now this Golden Brigade, are these the same guys that you wrote about a couple of weeks ago who are basically the Special Forces Rangers, the only competent part of the official Iraqi army?
There's three competent units, and they are one of them. In the Iraqi army, the article you're referencing, I basically concluded that they've got about 10,000 guys at any given moment who are, operational and functional in combat, and everybody else will just sort of run away or isn't properly trained or equipped. And we don't even have hard numbers on how many other guys they've got. But, the Iraqi army is basically at any given time at the most able to deploy about 10,000 competent guys that officially work for the government. That, of course, doesn't include the Shia militias.
Mm-hmm. And now, I don't have a map in front of me, but isn't Ramadi much further from Baghdad than Fallujah is? Why did it take the Islamic State all this time to be able to grab it?
Partially, that is true. Basically, there's a straight line between Amman, Jordan, and Baghdad. If you're coming from Amman, Ramadi's the first major city that you hit. And then shortly after that, Fallujah, and then you hit Abu Ghraib, and then Baghdad itself. One of the reasons is because it's the provincial capital. And also, there are pro-government tribes because of government, sort of subsidies and patronage and just history. In Ramadi itself, whereas Fallujah's kind of always been at least insurgent prone, if not, quite a bit of outright sympathy for the Islamic State. So the fact that even though it's closer to Baghdad, that it would fall sooner isn't a terribly big surprise. What's a big surprise is that for, well over a year now, keep in mind Anbar was pretty much taken over by pissed off tribesmen and the Islamic State back in January of 2014, well before Mosul, is that they've known that this is going to happen, the Iraqi government. They've had, more than a year to prepare, billions in international aid, hundreds of U.S. airstrikes, and they just got overrun in a day.
Yeah, well, so, it's a funny way to start this part of the conversation, but I saw Oliver North on TV this morning. Try to watch only Fox News now. And he was, basically making the same complaint, only elaborating, saying, look, there's no one. If this is the state of things in Ramadi, then it's a fantasy that even with American air power, that the Iraqi government and its allies could ever take Mosul. I mean, just forget about it. And I guess he didn't say the same thing for Fallujah, but same thing for Fallujah, same thing for the rest of the Anbar province, same thing for the rest of the Islamic State is the point, right? They can't take Mosul. If they can't hold Ramadi, then they can't do a damn thing. But then again, I guess counter to that would be the recent recapture of Tikrit by the Iraqi army. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, first off, I mean, just thank you for putting me in the terribly uncomfortable position of agreeing with anything Oliver North says. but the fact is, he's right. And, you know, yes, there was a victory in Tikrit. But if you look on a map and you look at the size of Tikrit, it's relatively close to Baghdad. The Iraqi government had held things north along that highway before. So they were sort of able to, using the Kurds and Shia militias even coming in from the east, they were able to isolate a town of about 150 to 200,000 people to Crete. Ramadi's about like 800,000 people, maybe nine. Mosul is 200,000. I mean, 2 million, sorry. Mosul's the second biggest city in Iraq. It's well over 2 million people. Fallujah goes about 500,000. These are big places, and they take a long time to take down. So I'd even argue the fact that the Iraqi government can't properly protect the oil refinery that's been under siege for a year in Baiji, mm-hmm. in an area that they actually have a little bit better command and control and maneuverability than they do, let's say, in Ramadi, they haven't been able to secure that properly. If you can't do that, you can't even start thinking about Mosul. And obviously, this is in, you know, the developments today in Anbar, which could conceivably get worse. Ramadi might not be the end of this. There's a town called al-Baghdadi that essentially is about to fall as well. And if it does, then the entire garrison at the Haditha Dam, which has held out for this entire time, they are now cut off completely. Haditha Dam, you know, can supply a tremendous amount of electricity. It can also flood half of Iraq. It's not a, not something you want in the hands of the Islamic State, much like the Mosul Dam. So if Baghdadi falls, that's a really big tactical problem for resupply and for continued government control over one of the biggest infrastructure projects in Iraq. And then on top of it, you're talking about losing some other towns that, to the point that then you start wondering, how secure are those U.S. trainers sitting on Al Asad Air Base, which is in Anbar? And that would be, at that stage, one of the last points of control for the U.S. government. I mean, not for the U.S. government, for the Iraqi government with U.S. support in all of, you know, Western Iraq. So at this stage, you know, right now there's got to be a meeting at the Pentagon going, okay, if these dominoes fall, which is looking increasingly likely, are we going to end up in a situation where we have to pull these trainers out of Assad Air Base because, you know, they're not there for a combat mission, so they'd have to either redefine the mission as a combat-oriented one or pull them out for somewhere safer because Assad Air Base will be up next.
Yeah, well, my bet is always on escalation, but then again, I've been wrong. I thought they would have had 10,000 Marines there by now or more, you know, really escalating this thing, and they seem very hesitant to do that, thank goodness. But on the question of the dam, man, I really should have a map here in front of me while we're talking about this, but is there a chance for it to just be basically resupplied and protected by the Kurds? Because isn't it closer to Kurdistan than Baghdad anyway?
No. This is imagine basically there's the river that comes down through, you know, all of Syria and Turkey and then straight down into, you know, the Euphrates River Valley. It's up in that. And so essentially it connects, let's say, Ramadi to Deir ez-Zor in the Syrian desert, which is mostly under the control of the Islamic State. I think there's still one or two small Syrian bases, regime bases that are holding out inside Deir ez-Zor, but they can't leave their base, and they'll be overrun and probably massacred in short order as well. So that's the connection. Is essentially it draws a straight line between Ramadi and then, if you want to, all the way up to Raqqa. So this is a major supply line for the Islamic State, but it's also one they've had pretty good control over in the past. The guys that are in the Haditha Dam are able to control it, but they're not going on patrols and disrupting, you know, operations around them. They're dug in for dear life, you know, hoping for resupply.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now, this is almost ridiculous, I guess, but we got to talk about it. It's a very well done piece that you have here about the new Sons of Iraq, supposedly, right? The new Concerned Local Citizens movement from when America cooperated with the Sunni tribes on the Awakening. Am I right here to oversimplify it more or less and say that you have the tribal factions, the Baathists, and the Bin Ladenites, and that basically it's a question of which two can be allied together against the third, like the Sith, that kind of thing?
Well, it's more like this. I mean, first off, it is a comparable, you know, analogy between what the Americans very successfully did, particularly in Anbar and Saladin in from 2007 and 8. But really what this is supposed to symbolize is everyone knows this is not going away unless the Shia-dominated government in Baghdad reconciles with an extremely angry and paranoid Sunni population that has, even if it doesn't embrace the Islamic State, is very unhappy at the government. So, you know, a lot of people will either join the Islamic State hoping to get a better, you know, angle for their tribe and then maybe change sides down the road, or they're going to sit things out. This was a move by the Iraqi government to sort of encourage the Sunnis to come into the fold. I cannot imagine that getting overrun in Ramadi, and right now guys that have joined that movement and tribes that are known to be sympathetic or willing to talk to the government, I have reports at least 50 have been summarily executed today alone in Ramadi. So that's not exactly going to be a great recruiting poster. But it is an acknowledgement that the Shia government is never going to get anywhere dealing with the Islamic State until they bring in large numbers of the Sunni tribes back into the fold, start paying them off, giving them jobs, which is how everything here in Iraq works, is money, jobs, patronage, political power, just like anywhere else. And until they start doing that, these tribes are either going to quietly align with the Islamic State or they're going to just stay out of it, you know, and try not to get killed by either side. So what we have seen is a very weak early effort. You know, my article was fairly harsh on it, but it is a step in the right direction. It just has to be done in a serious manner and heavily resourced. And a lot of these guys think the Americans are going to show up and do it, and everybody needs to come to grips with the fact that they're not coming.
Well, now, but the thing of it is, though, you know, under the premise that they were back then when it supposedly worked, they got enough of a victory out of it to go ahead and call it one anyway, with the cooperation between the Americans and the tribes back then against Al-Qaeda. The premise was that they would be incorporated into the government then, but at the same time, it was kind of obvious that you're creating a whole new separate army, more or less, not maybe quite as professional as the actual Iraqi army, although we saw how professional it was. But the idea that, you know, it was a big bet that they would somehow be integrated into, the Shia-dominated government and military. And instead, what they did was they just created a parallel Sunni army and armed it up. And it's, you know, partly now the Islamic State itself. So, I mean, for all the mistrust and all the history there from the Civil War and the rest of it, is that even possible in a million years now that they're going to actually achieve Petraeus's failed benchmarks of 2007 and integrate the Sons of Iraq into the army? I mean, when you say jobs, you mean in the army and even somewhat in the officer corps, right? Or nothing?
Well, I mean, look, you know, everybody's got to get out of this paradigm of considering this to be 2007, because it's not. I mean, this is, you know, 2015, and the entire dynamic here has changed from that period. You know, I'm not the world's biggest fan of General Petraeus, but he was successful in that particular area. And, you know, when the Americans left, there had been an agreement on the table that these guys would get integrated into security forces. You have to understand, in a society like Iraq, which can be very tribal and very sectarian, and people have a tendency not to trust outsiders. I mean, I guess that's common the world around. But, you know, having a cop from Nasiriyah in Fallujah is a recipe for disaster. So understanding that you will always have to incorporate local guys into, you know, the security forces that patrol local areas, it's absolutely critical, if only because they'll fight to protect their own neighborhoods. They know who the bad guys are, and they know how normal life looks. If you don't do it that way, you end up with things like Mosul, where the Iraqi army ran away because, well, the heck if I was going to get killed for a government I don't even like in a city I don't even live in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is what the ultimate failure for this was on Maliki, who, upon the Americans' departure with all these promises, looked at these guys and said, wait a minute, you're a bunch of Sunni terrorists. We're not going to help you. And then, in fact, started arresting a lot of them, you know, the very guys that had helped take out al-Qaeda to a certain extent in 2007, 2008, 2009. So if you're a Sunni tribesman, you have absolutely no reason to trust, you know, Nouri al-Maliki. You're hoping that they will eventually find a way to trust the new government, But, you know, it's going to be a long, tough slog ahead, particularly because the new government is starting to find itself chafing against a group of Shia militias that are extremely sectarian, hate the Sunnis, and answer only really to Iran, not to the prime minister of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So once you factor that in, it's, I mean, I hate to be pessimistic, but it's very difficult for me to see how they will eventually integrate Sunnis into a proper organizational structure, even if it's with some autonomy, you know, but they're going to have to if they're ever going to solve this. There's just no other way around it.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like you're saying they're not going to solve it. Hey, tell me, when they invaded Tikrit and drove the Islamic State out of Tikrit, what was the proportion of Abadi's Iraqi army versus the Shiite militias?
Well, it's not like, you know, the Shia militias don't exactly send their data like to Jane's defense, so it can be hard for us to judge sometimes. But the general impression that we got in that situation was that the militias had pushed up from Diyala province on one side and really ended up closing the net, sort of, on a lot of farmland. When you say something like Tikrit, you know, you're talking about a city of maybe about 100,000 people, but then it's surrounded by like miles and miles of farmland with, let's say, another 50 to 100,000 farmers living in villages and, you know, those areas like that. They were able to successfully cordon it off at extremely high casualties. At a couple of points, we don't have good numbers on this, but one of my colleagues, Loveday Morris, in the Washington Post, did a great story where she went down to the Shia cemetery in Najaf and just counted how many bodies had come in that day to be buried there from Tikrit, and it was something like 100. So if you extrapolated, you know, they'd lost like 3,000 guys at least dead in the course of a month-long siege. But at the very end, when it turned into house-to-house fighting, this weird little kabuki theater went on where the U.S. said, we're not going to help you if you have these Iranian-backed Shia militias going into a Sunni area. The government basically agreed with that assessment and sort of froze the militias as a cordon surrounding the city. And at that stage, guys like the Golden Division, the SWAT, you know, a couple of other, like I said, there's about three useful units that are pretty well trained, to be fair. And those guys were the ones that went in and did the last final push into the center of Tikrit. So it was a group effort, but it's a group effort that geographically will be very hard for them to replicate in other places. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Shia militias had access to that area from Diyala province. It's not so far afield from where they generate from.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like the Iraqi army really needs them.
Well, yeah, I mean, he really needs them. You know, it's one of these things where it's like chemotherapy for cancer. I mean, at one point, yes, in a weird way, it's keeping you alive, but it's also poisoning your body. So, you know, at this stage, I don't think anybody thinks it's a brilliant idea that more guys with guns who are not under the direct control of the central government are running around Iraq. But having said that, if they didn't have those guys, things would probably look a lot worse right now. Particularly for the Shia in the south, who have, you know, gotten out of this relatively unscathed. There's been some attacks in Baghdad. There's been fighting in Samarra and Diyala. But, you know, when you look at Basra, Nasiriyah, Najaf, Karbala, these places haven't even really suffered from car bombs or any of the things that we saw during the American occupation. So, in a sense, the Shia militias are protecting their community, which is what they claim to be doing. But it's not a great idea to have 50,000 guys running around with heavy weapons who don't exactly recognize the prime minister's authority.
Well, it's kind of funny, too, that it was the chemo that actually helped create the cancer in the first place. It was in remission for a little while, and now it's back. But 10 years ago, the El Salvador option of backing the Bada Brigade and using them to help pick Sunni targets was kind of what led to the Civil War and a big part of what led to the Civil War and all those killed back then.
And the
Sunnis into the arms of Zarqawi and his guys.
Right, but they were going to anyway. I mean, this is one thing, again, you know, I tend to downplay the influence at this stage, even back then, that the Americans had over guys like this. The simple fact was when the Badr organization, you know, arrived from their exile into Baghdad, they were going to hunt down and kill a lot of guys. It was just, they'd been at war with these people for 30 years. Every Badr Brigade member, I'm sorry, Badr organization now, not Badr Brigade, every official I've ever met has lost like a dozen of their immediate family members to torture from the Saddam regime or in car bombs that came later during the American occupation. You know, these are deep-seated rivalries and very tough people, you know, and so it was stupid to work with them on some level, but they were going to go do it anyway.
Yeah.
it's just the way it is.
Well, I mean,
that's how this town runs.
And
you know,
Sistani,
and they need weapons.
In January of 2004, the Supreme Ayatollah said, "Hey, we want one man, one vote, don't we, everybody?" And all of the Shia, 60% majority of the population, said, "Yep, that's right, we sure do." And they were the side we were already on at that point. So,
well, we, you know, this is the whole thing, though. I mean, I was there for that, and you know, as hypocritical as everybody is, you know, when it comes to world affairs, you know, allowing some system in when you've, you know, ostensibly gone in to find WMD that doesn't exist, but then you're like, we're going to drain the swamp of the Middle East and establish a wonderful democracy. You cannot roll in and then make sectarian quotas like you have in Lebanon. You've got to say one man, one vote, or else you're not America. The biggest mistake that had come out of all of that, I mean, besides invading Iraq in the first place, was actually on the part of the Sunnis, who then refused to participate at all in that election. And as a result, got cut out of the ministries. And by the time they realized that they had given up any sense of political power, in a sense, they still have not recovered from that. The ministries at that point were stacked with, you know, Sadr guys, Badr guys, you know, pro-Iranian guys, you know, Dawa, all of these different Shia groups got to divvy everything up with absolutely no input from a Sunni, you know, parliamentarian guys. So as a result, you know, they've almost never rebounded from that. They've been cut out ever since.
Yeah. Well, and it just goes to show democracy and liberty ain't the same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just, yeah, it just, I mean, it's, I mean, to put it mildly, there's a million conundrums here. But the one thing, you know, and I've got to go here in a second because I got to see if I can get anybody on the phone in Ramadi right now to find out what's happening. But, you know, I mean, you just have to look at it this way. Is this is an intractable problem until the regional actors decide that they're going to do something about it. That's Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, you know, the Sunnis of Anbar, the Jordanians, even, you know, to a certain extent, whatever's left over there in Syria at this stage, I'm not sure there's a functioning anything. This is a problem everybody's going to have to work out and address. And you can really look at the Islamic State as just a symptomatic, you know, example of what happens when you run a completely screwed political system for 50 or 60 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, about how intractable it is, though, I mean, the battle of the five armies that you're talking about is just not going to happen. Saudi and Iran and Turkey all working together to get rid of the Islamic State. I mean, it's amazing, of course. It's almost unreal that it's gotten this far, that you have this guy, Baghdadi, calling himself the caliph over all of his territory, the size of Great Britain, as Patrick Coburn always emphasizes. But who's going to undo it? The Turks aren't going to invade. They probably could invade. You know, they have a 300,000-man army, right, and high tech.
Oh, they could.
But they're not
going
to.
Now, that's the whole thing is, but neither's America. So, you know, right now America's in a let's contain it to make you know, to see what we can do to keep this from getting worse while the regional actors get their act together. You're right. I mean, I have a hard time seeing any of these, you know, basically venal incompetent morons ever getting their act together. But they're really going to have to if they don't want this place to burn.
Hey, can I ask you one more thing before we go?
Sure.
Can you talk about what's going on? I know you're basically in Eastern Islamic State territory, but I'm interested in what's going on in the West and ISIS and Nusra Gains in Syria. Can you talk about that at all in Idlib province and all that?
A little bit, but what we're seeing is, you know, essentially I am working on something involving this right now. The big thing at the end of the day for the Syrian regime is a numbers game. They're starting to run out of men. If you look at the real numbers of people killed, everybody talks about the civilians, but the biggest number of people killed in the Syrian civil war have been pro-regime fighters. As a result, they do not have a huge population of guys that are still loyal, and they're starting to suffer a little bit. So you've seen Nusra and Ahrar get their act together, be very pragmatic and work with a lot of coalitions. It's clear that Turkey and Saudi are dumping a lot more money, a lot more effectively into that. And as a result, those guys are taking over a lot of stuff. So you're starting to see the Islamic State trying to remind everybody that they're relevant in Syria as well. But the one thing I've taken away from the last year is the Islamic State's happy to control Raqqa, but they're run by Iraqis. Their primary interest appears to be Iraq. They're not going to commit huge amounts of men and material to a fight for Aleppo when they can be taking over Ramadi, where half of them are from in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Nusra? They're going to keep going and focusing on Aleppo and then even Damascus?
Of course. I mean, Nusra is the most effective fighting force among the rebels that are genuinely trying to overthrow the regime. They work well with even fairly secular groups for the most part. They might be Kaida guys, but they're, you know, sort of, at least for now, a sort of new version of Kaida guy who knows how to work with, play well with others, which is something that we have not seen before. So it's sort of hard to predict where Noosr might go with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, chances are it won't turn out well if a bunch of jihadis take over Damascus. But I will say, you know, they have proven themselves to be much more pragmatic and flexible than, you know, Salafist jihadist groups that we've seen in conflicts all over the region in the past.
What do you think is the real danger that Damascus will fall, I don't know, in the next year or something?
I don't know. You know, it's really hard. We do not have great optics, but I would just say, if it's a war of attrition, eventually the rebels are going to win. There's just, they've got more men. And Iran is backing, you know, the Syrian regime. They kept them afloat this long, more or less. They would have fallen long ago if it wasn't for Iran and Hezbollah. But Iran has real problems right now in Iraq as well. And that's closer to their border. And, you know, everybody's got an oil crunch. Prices are not high right now. The Iranian government is not flush with cash like it would have been a few years ago. The Saudi government can kind of afford to ride this out, but they're dumping money into, you know, their Nusra guys. Syria, you know, I wouldn't say like imminent fall of Damascus, like some pundits are starting to come out with, which, you know, I think is either they don't know or it's nonsense. But definitely, you know, if this is a war of attrition, bet on the 20 million, not on the 4 million.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for your time, Mitch. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that's Mitch Prothero writing for McClatchy Newspapers at McClatchyDC.com. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. So, I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, that's depressing news, dude. Iraq is going to be a mess for a long time. I guess it ain't even Iraq anymore. I mean, when I hear Mitch Prothero talk about what's got to happen for them to get this together, for the Islamic State to ever be defeated and Iraq to exist as a state again, as a united society again, in the way that it was, in any sense. Nope. It's not going to happen. David Petraeus did not succeed in any way. He didn't achieve the benchmarks at all. He got the Sunni tribes to turn on the Al-Qaeda fighters for a while. But were the sons of Iraq, that is the Sunni militias that he bribed to stop attacking America, American forces in Iraq, I mean, pardon me, to be clear. Were they ever going to be integrated into the Iraqi army, which was built out of the Badr Brigade anyway? Like Prothero says, once you invade the place, the Badr Brigade's going to do their own El Salvador option anyway. The Iraqi army is made out of the Badr Brigade in the first place. So, you heard what he said. Yeah, you know, the Iraqi government, at least it's not Maliki anymore. Correct, it's not Maliki anymore. He was really ham-handed and stupid and helped play into his enemy's hands in major ways here. No doubt about that. But it's also too late for it to matter that it's not Maliki anymore. How many tens of billions of dollars would a body have to make available to the Sunni tribal chiefs and somehow enforce it that they're not just going to take off to Dubai, you know, but they're going to hang around and spend all that money building up a giant Sunni army to take on the Islamic State on the turf they've already conquered, and then backed by the Iraqi army and the Badr Brigade and the other Shiite militias. It's just not going to happen, dude. That is not going to happen. It's already way too late for that. Iraq is already broken. Go ahead and start calling it Southern Shiistan. I'm sure they're going to start calling it Southern Iraqi Shiistan, a.k.a. George W. Bush's stan, Ayatollah land. They'll quote me exactly, but they'll never say, as Scott Horton says. Southern Iraqi Shiistan versus the Islamic State. That's what it is now. Go ahead and update your map, Rand McNally. They insist on calling him ISIS just because it's a pain in the ass to write IS is. But you know what? You could just call it the Islamic State. That's what it is. That's the name of it. It's a damn state now. They did it. And it's funny the way they keep pretending this isn't a fact. Like this didn't already happen in June. Where this guy said, I declare myself the president. Anybody, the dictator, the caliph. Anybody challenge me? Between here and Raqqa? Yeah, that's what I thought. Sounds like a monopoly on violence to me. And anyway, I'm not agitating for an American invasion. I'm just saying I can't imagine any other form of their destruction than that. And of course, even then, I can't imagine that. Don't misquote me there either, because all I mean is that the worst the Americans could do to these guys would be to turn them back into a militia. Okay, you're not a state anymore. Now you're a militia again. We're able to drop enough paratroopers at the old border between Syria and Iraq to build the berm back up and call it a border again for now. But then what? Occupy that land forever? Bribe enough Sunni sheikhs and tribal leaders, like already failed to happen back in the so-called awakening when they had 150,000 troops there to make it all enforceable and bring them into the Baghdad government? Too late. It's like the man said, too late since March the, 28th or something, 2003. Right around the time Baghdad Bob was saying, no, everything's fine. What are you talking about? The Americans, they can't do nothing. Right around then was when it was too late. But so now, you know, I don't know. It's funny. I think the last article I wrote for antiwar.com was called Finding Ways to Stay in Iraq. And it was about Obama's promise to leave and how it was all a lie and he wasn't going to leave and he was going to stay. And look at all the loopholes and technicalities. What about air power? What about so-called counterterrorism forces that they say are not combat troops? And what about all the force protection for them? They're not combat troops either. And what about all the Marines and the gigantic Vatican-sized embassy and all of this stuff? But if you read that article... And you know what? It's funny is that got passed around by the military intelligence newspaper in Iraq. That article back then. And somebody sent it to the other Scott Horton, and then he sent it to me. And maybe that's why they published it. They thought it was by him. I don't know. But anyway, great article. But in there, I completely wrongly, ridiculously mock the idea, the insane and non-possibility, as Cheney said, that if we leave, that Al-Qaeda could take over even part of Iraq, even Iraqi Sunnistan. That'll never fall into the actual rule of these bin Ladenite jihadists. That's impossible. They always were the slightest percentage of the Iraqi insurgency and, you know, the useful help and mostly a bunch of foreigners. And they'd never rule the place. You know, even if they can't reintegrate with the Iraqi government, it'll still be run by more or less the Sons of Iraq, right? They'll be the Sunni Iraqi army ruling Sunnistan. But you know what I could not have anticipated? I should have. I'll blame myself. But here's what I could not have anticipated when I wrote that. That Barack Obama was going to fight two wars in Libya and in Syria on behalf of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The very same guys, the veterans, the Libyan veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they call themselves Ansar al-Sharia and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Those are the Libyan fighters who went to Iraq to fight with Zarqawi against America and the Shiite and Iranian-backed militias then. Obama fought a whole war for them against Gaddafi. Turned the whole place into jihadistan in North Africa. And then the first thing they did was start putting Mujahideen and guns on boats and send them off to export the same war to Syria right away. And yet again, right away, it was apparent. Go back and listen to interviews on this show. It's only because I've been doing this all along is why, and I'm right about everything in real time, is why I can always say go back and check the coverage at the time. And you could see that we knew that this was not going to be as easy as the war in Libya. At least the war in Libya had a very simple geographical kind of push to it. Fighters from the east invading the west and backed by American and NATO air power and scant forces to oppose them. And it was a simple matter of time. I mean, it took 9 damn months, so it wasn't nearly as easy as they said it was going to be before they finally lynched Gaddafi on the side of the road. It was still, you know, it was just a matter of time all along. Turned out to be a lot longer than they thought, but it was simpler, you know, kind of thing. In Syria, it was pretty obvious that they weren't going to do it. And then, of course, Russia was not going to agree on the Security Council again to another no-fly zone. And it was also clear from the very beginning that the middle and upper class Sunni Arabs were on the side of Assad, not the Mujahideen. So even though the Sunni Arabs are 70% supermajority of the population of Syria, didn't mean that they were all on the side of the insurgency and that it was a sectarian war of them versus everybody else, because many Sunnis supported the government too. Mostly the rebellion, the actual war, was supported by foreign powers. The Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Israelis, and the Americans. And it was under, you know what? It's a counterfactual, so you can't say with scientific certainty or anything like that, but it sure seems probable that, brutal and fascist and evil as Assad is, the war would have been over, many fewer people would have died, and there never would have been a real rise of the Islamic State if America and its allies hadn't backed the rise of the al-Nusra Front and their allies. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Would you believe this? Of course you would. Mother Jones is reporting that the cops investigating the killing of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old with the toy gun, they haven't even interviewed the cop that shot him. That was more than 6 months ago. They haven't even questioned him yet. Yeah. See, America, we have a constitution and a rule of law, and the whole premise is that every single one of us has the same divine right as the King of England, and so therefore, we're each divine. We all got very, very special rights. And our government, why, we allow it to exist, to be our security force, to protect our natural liberty only. And they are our servants, and they take good care of us. And they're just citizens, just like us. We, the people, are the government, and it is us. And if you're a cop who murders a 12-year-old boy, they don't even get around to questioning you within half a year. And everyone knows that you'll get away with it. Everyone. The other column on my Twitter feed is the young black female prosecutor in Baltimore defending herself from charges that she's a young black female. Uh-huh. Bias against our heroic white cop overlord killers. Well, okay, half of them are black. But still, same difference. And her defense is, I'm just doing my job. Really? The law says that you're not allowed to murder people, you know, so I got to prosecute people if they murder somebody. And there's outrage and howls, especially on the right. Although I guess they're happy to see the three black cops prosecuted. It's kind of torn there. But, you know, what an anomaly. She's merely the exception that proves the rule. How many prosecutors are young black women who will go ahead and proudly and defiantly indict and prosecute a cop for killing somebody. Right, only her. That's right. And that's it. So, the rule is proved by the shadow cast by her light. Simple as that. All right. Anyway, sorry. I want to spend this segment talking about the Nakba. I'll at least mention it here. See, I'm not good enough on this, and I swear to you, I tried to contact 3 or 4 different Palestinians this morning to talk about it, and I thought, you know, it'd be patronizing to get a liberal, you know, anti-Zionist Jew on to talk about it, even though there are some really great ones who know all about this, have written at length about this, and have very important stuff to say. It's also kind of patronizing to always be interviewing liberal Jews about Palestine instead of Palestinians, you know? But then I completely failed at getting a hold of any of the Palestinians that I know that I can interview about stuff sometimes. So instead, I don't know, maybe next week. It doesn't have to be on the same day, who cares, right? Anyway, but today is Nakba Day, the day that they commemorate the expulsion of something around the order of 750,000 Palestinians from their homes in 1948. And it should be known, and Philip Weiss has done a good job of helping me understand how all this worked too, how after the UN partition, the Israeli Jews were still taking more and more land way beyond what was allowed and picking a fight with the Palestinians and going far beyond the UN mandate. And that was what precipitated the war. And then that became the excuse. Oh, look, they invaded us, so we have to defend ourselves and seize a whole bunch more land, too. And then, so that's why they don't ever refer to 1947 borders. They refer to 48 borders, because that's at least the fait accompli right there. But then, so that means that there are, at this point now, millions of refugees living in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, in Syria, although living may be an exaggeration when it comes to the Palestinians in Syria right now. And, you know, in the Gaza Strip, the population there are 80% refugees from, you know, where they can see their father's village from over the wall, their grandfathers. Their fathers are all dead. Nah, I don't know. Anyway, it's a hell of a thing. And see, the way that they got away with it was just by pretending it ain't true, and just by kind of blatant, you know, if you can imagine this, on the heels of World War II, Jewish refugees of the Holocaust basically exploiting white supremacist notions that, hey, they're Europeans at least, and their skin is lighter colored, and hey, the Arabs, we'll just at least portray them as not existing or being a bunch of savages where we have to admit they do exist. And then, so, under what was perfectly politically correct at the time, screw the Arabs, who cares about them? They're basically a bunch of Red Indians to just be pushed out of the way. But it turns out that that's led to a permanent problematic type of a problem here. And then what compounds it and what makes it so much worse is the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem since 1967. And listen to how Gideon Levy writes about this in his article. The more Israel represses the Nakba, the stronger the memories in Haaretz today. He says, has Israel ever abandoned the policy that caused the Nakba? Isn't it the same policy of dispossession, occupation, oppression, destruction, and expulsion that continues to this day, 67 years after 1948? 48 years after 1967. Isn't that interesting? I mean, not that it means anything, just kind of a funny quirk of mathematics and all of that. 67 years since 1948 and the war and the declaration of the Israeli state, well, or the, you know, the real foundation of the Israeli state, and 48 years since 1967 when the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem began. And so, you know, I don't know, man. I guess if they had withdrawn to 1967 borders back in 1995 under Yitzhak Rabin, there would still be people in the Middle East who would be against the existence of the Israeli state at all. However, that's a cheap excuse, mostly, because here's what's important. The Palestinian Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat agreed to recognize Israel under 1967 borders back in 1988. And according to the Saudi peace plan, which Iran has signed on to as well, they will all officially recognize Israel if they withdraw from the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And then, oh, you can try to move the goalposts and say, oh, no, they have to recognize it as a Jewish state. But, of course, that's not Israeli law. They don't have a constitution. And in their so-called basic laws, they're still debating whether they should have a real declaration. It's kind of tradition to be a Jewish state and a democratic state, but it would have the effect if they declared a Jewish state. Hey, I didn't hear the bumper music. I'm going to finish my thought anyway for you archive listeners. If they call it a Jewish state, then that would... and not democratic at the same time, then it would sound like they're putting one in precedent over the other, and they've been very reluctant to do that. Oh, but all the neighbor states have to go ahead and go that far, though, before it'll be good enough, huh? Yeah, anyway.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so now listen... Well, you know, this whole Jeb Bush thing is an ongoing thing. I've been predicting that he would be the president in after the next election for 3 or 4 or 5 years now or some long. How long ago did I make that sticker, Get Your Son Killed, Jeb Bush 2016? I think that was in 2013 or maybe 2012. Anyway, I just like to play these little thought experiments. You know, when I was in high school, 1994, as soon as I heard that not only was Jeb, but George Bush was running for governor, too, in my home state of Texas. It was as simple as that, to figure it out right there in math class. I think it was a sophomore. Might have been a junior. Right there in math class. Don't you see what they're doing? They're ensuring that no matter what, one of these guys will be an incumbent governor by the year 2000. He'll be in his second term as governor. And will be able to run for president in the year 2000. So, watch. They're going to throw the next election for Bill. And then, of course, they nominated Bob Dole, who couldn't have possibly won, which I don't know if they had anybody who could have, but that was my conspiracy, and it sure played out. Not that I'm always right, but, you know, when I'm predicting the future, but it seems pretty clear to me that Bush has all the power locked up. The only people who say that doesn't make any sense because nobody likes George Jeb Bush, really, and his name is Bush, and he hasn't, you know. Yeah, but the people with power like him. Did you think this was about you? You know that it's not about you. So quit with the cognitive dissonance and all that, you know? Can he ultimately be sold to the majority of the right to stop Hillary? That's the only question, you know? But now here's the thing of it. It's true that he is named George Bush. And it's true that with time, it becomes easier, I guess, for even in the mainstream, for people to talk about George W. Bush's problems. Boy, in real time, you were the problem if you dared to take the stand against the Bush administration, at least until after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. It was just impossible to... Oh, you just hate Bush. You just love terrorists and hate America. That stuff was just out of control. Now it's been so long. And, of course, liberals like to excuse Obama by blaming everything Obama did on Bush, even though, of course, Bush is as guilty as hell of everything. But still, they kind of like piling that on. And Jeb is, hey, he's the older brother. He signed the PNAC documents when Junior wasn't even thinking along those lines yet. Back in 1998. And he's got the same last name. And people can't ignore what the 19-year-old girl accused Jeb of the other day. Your brother created ISIS. Now, she can't really argue it out. And the Republican argument that, no, Obama should have just left troops there. Liberals need to actually learn a little bit of the history of that war so that they can argue that point. Because there's a hell of a lot more to it than that. But it's a pretty easy talking point to shut them down if they don't know how to keep arguing after that. And it actually worked for Jeb in that case. But anyway, kind of everybody knows that, look, man, if Saddam with the clean-shaven chin and the beret and the olive-green uniform was here, then we wouldn't be talking about the Islamic terrorist state. And bin Laden was not, I mean, they did it to me, you see. Saddam was not an anti-American terrorist. And Lori Milroy was wrong, and none of that stuff was true, and he didn't back Al-Qaeda against us, or at all. And everybody knows that. If only Uday and Kusay were here, we wouldn't have to be worried about this stupid Islamic state. And so how's he going to live that down? And then there's so many corollary questions. And see, here's what happened, too. As I said this yesterday, but it's an important point. Someone pointed out to me in the Twitter, because Jeb flubbed the question so bad, knowing what you know now, not knowing if you were back then and this and that kind of talking point, he screwed up his talking points. And he just opened the door for this giant debate. And now even Scott Walker is saying, knowing what we know now, I definitely would not have done it either. And now everybody's agreeing. But this just opens the door to so many questions. So everybody agrees then that if Saddam did have a little bit of mustard gas, that would have been a good enough reason to invade that country. You didn't learn anything else. There's nothing else about the consequences of invading that country. There's nothing else about that you've learned about starting a war and what all that might mean. And Jeb Bush said, I didn't want to answer because that would be like saying all the soldiers died in vain. I mean, and in fact, they didn't. They didn't. Okay, well, tell me how they didn't. They died for a war that you're saying shouldn't have been launched. That has led to nothing but strategic consequences of the absolute worst imaginable kind of a scale. Of course they all died in vain. I mean, no offense to anybody's dad, you know, listening, whose son died out there or whatever, personally kind of thing. I don't mean it like that, but the politicians, yeah, they wasted a bunch of American soldiers' lives. A million Iraqis died in that thing. A million. 5 million were made refugees. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of widows and orphans. Ethnic, religious, minority group, ethnic and religious minority groups shattered and scattered to the winds, destroyed. Their entire society turned upside down in that war. But apparently the only question is whether the intelligence on the WMD was good enough, huh? Really? Because the way I remember 2002 was this decision was decided at the very top and they dragged the entire rest of the government along with them. A lot of people couldn't understand it. A lot of people said, look, I only know a little bit about the Middle East, but I know Saddam and Osama ain't the same damn thing. What are they doing? Okay, I guess. I guess Saddam must have been involved in 9/11 somehow, or else why would we be attacking him? I guess we better attack him. Come on, guys, we're all doing this, huh? Okay. But as Jon Stewart said to Judith Miller in his interview with her, which I only saw the first part of that. I really should have watched the whole thing. He said, here's why I'm not buying that. There was an agenda. They had to work hard to change the subject to Iraq, and you helped them do that. This is not a matter of just, reporting what you thought were facts out of context. This was a huge push to get this thing done. And why? And who benefited? Who was supposed to have benefited, and who actually did? And now only Rand Paul can get up there and say, I would have voted against it, even with the intelligence at the time, because, and here's why. Now, I haven't heard his here's why, And I know it's not going to be as good as his dad's because he's more of a dilettante type, man. He doesn't spend enough time reading about this stuff to really have a good answer. But there, you know, anyway, point is, we still got a year and a half of this to go. And the presumed front runner by a million miles is the zillionaire, in effect, the zillionaire, Jeb Bush. And, you know, I read this thing saying that Jeb and Karl Rove ain't necessarily all together on this thing. Yeah, right. They're just building up a whole other giant separate establishment to go ahead and maybe back some others for a little while as a token and then double down for Jeb later. And tell me you're not seeing through that. Karl Rove's Crossroads money, and then Jeb Bush has his own set of super PACs and this and that. So he's the presumed front runner by a million miles, and his major baggage is that he's a Bush. It's not his record in Florida necessarily. Nobody really cares about that or whatever. It's all about his record as the brother of Bush Jr. who got us into that horrible war. So in other words, you know, really cool, and especially, again, because of his stupid flub, failing to put this thing to bed, we're going to keep having a big fight about this for a long time. And then there's so many related questions about, of course, spying, which the courts have declared unconstitutional and illegal, and the torture regime and lawless detention at Guantanamo Bay, and lawless secret CIA black site prisons all around the world, which apparently still exist at Diego Garcia, at least. Yeah, let's have a fight about the Patriot Act, etc. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott, and it's my show. Isn't that interesting? So they say, I wonder if this is a hoax or something. I guess not. I don't know. A rancher from Colorado fell in a ravine, hit her head, severe spine and brain injuries, total amnesia from her life before. But now, she's a brilliant poet and artist, whereas before she had no interest in such things at all. And has acquired savant syndrome. Go ahead and hit me in the head real hard, I guess, and see if it works. You know what? Try it on somebody else first. One more person has a control. All right. Gotta hit your head just right to become a poet out of the situation, I guess. All right. Anyway, hey, you know, I meant to mention this. Well, it's just as good in the Jeb Bush discussion as it is in the Palestine discussion here. Chaim Sabin says Hillary Clinton is the ideal candidate for Israel. And now she's not running for prime minister of Israel. She's running for president of the United States. But Chaim Sabin is saying it would be ideal for Israel if Hillary Clinton was the president of the United States, and so that's why he's backing her, because of his Israeli interest. Now, who is Chaim Sabin? Chaim Sabin is the guy that made $1 billion off the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which those were actually after my time, but I know what they are. And anyway, I'm sure you know what they are, the brightly colored kung fu weirdo thing for little kids that they had in the 90s and whatever. So anyway, this guy's a zillionaire now, and he took the kind of center-left Democrat Brookings Institution and turned it into just another neocon think tank now, the Sabin Center there. He's the guy that, man, I don't know, it's going to take too long to explain the whole conversation, but he was all caught up in the Jane Harmon influence peddling with Israel situation there, where Jane Harmon was caught, Congresswoman Jane Harmon, on the House Intelligence Committee, and who was in line to be its chair and was also considered to be director of the Central Intelligence Agency for a time, was caught on the phone on a legal wiretap, a legit wiretap of an Israeli spy. She tried to spin it like, when the NSA was spying on me. No, they weren't. They were spying on an Israeli spy. And what were you doing on the phone with him, lady? Well, here's what she was doing on the phone with him. She was promising to try to pressure the Justice Department to back off the prosecution of Rosen and Weissman if they would put pressure on Nancy Pelosi to make her chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and to threaten Pelosi that Haim Saban would withhold his money from her if she did not bow to their wishes. Well, Pelosi didn't go for it because the NSA had tipped her off. Too bad they didn't wait around with the FBI to see what Pelosi says first. Hardy har har har, that might have been interesting. But they warned Pelosi, and so she stiff-armed Harmon, and it didn't happen. But then she did talk to the Justice Department and pressure them to back off the prosecution of Rosen and Weissman. And there were documents on the other side that showed that Alberto Gonzalez had, you know, said, well, I'll take your view under advisement if you will help us out on the illegal NSA spying front. And so then this lady who later claimed, oh, boo-hoo, they were illegally spying on me, when they were in fact legally spying on an actual Israeli spy, agent of a foreign power under the old and legitimate rules, she went ahead and ran interference for the illegal spying campaign in the House of Representatives. And then what did all the liberals and the major newspapers said? Oh, even Jane Harmon, the Democrat, says it's okay. And so that's how we know it's okay, because she's protecting our left flank on this issue. So 100% of all Republicans are unanimous that no American has the right to not be unreasonably searched by the NSA. And plus Jane Harmon, too. And so that's 51, and that's all you need. That was the argument in 2005 and 6, and it worked. So anyway, that's who Haim Saban is. I summed that up pretty quick, don't you think? Check out Jeff Stein for that great reporting. He's the one who broke all of that. And anyway, so I just think, isn't it worth pointing out that Haim Saban is not an American citizen? Haim Saban is an Israeli. And to me, it just seems kind of unseemly. It seems like the Israel lobby themselves would say, you know, it's a little bit unseemly. Steve Rosen, the old head of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, once told Jeffrey Goldberg, former corporal, prison guard in the occupied territories, and a former liar of you into war in 2003, and now commissar of all politically correct journalism on this issue at The Atlantic, that, man, I said so many things about Goldberg, I forgot what I was going to say about him. Who told Goldberg? Oh, yeah, Steve Rosen told Jeffrey Goldberg back when he was at The New Yorker that the lobby is like a night flower. It blooms in the darkness and shrivels in the light. He also, in the same conversation, said, see this cocktail napkin? By this time tomorrow, I could have the signature of 70 senators, that is a super-duper majority, of the United States Senate on this napkin. In other words, they'll do whatever I tell them. I got them all by the balls, Goldberg. Isn't that funny? Now go... We're best served as a night flower without much attention. Now go print that in The New Yorker. Oh, okay. And then Goldberg turns around and prints it in The New Yorker, so we all have it to look and point at. It just seems a little bit unseemly that it's being made, you know, quite apparent where, you know, again, Jeb, when he said, oh, foreign policy advisor, that'd be George W. Bush, my brother. He backtracked and said, no, I was only referring to on Israel issues. Because where was he? He was in Manhattan meeting with Paul Singer, the zillionaire who cares only about, which at least I think he's an American citizen, unlike Haim Saban. But he's just another Sheldon Adelson type who cares only about Israel. And there's this other guy, too. I forgot his name here. Norman Brahman, the Florida businessman that they've been writing about over at the Mondo Weiss blog. He's over there meeting these guys. And even for a Bush, they have to completely kowtow to the representatives of a foreign power. in order to be in the running for president of the United States, even for a Bush. He's got to say, no, you, me, and Bill Kristol, we all believe the same stuff, I swear. It's just a bit unseemly. It seems like they would do better if they went back to the night flower thing, although I admit I'm a bit appreciative in a way that it's becoming this apparent. But that's a real problem. But, yeah, anyway, so there's some of that, man. I think it's important. Oh, and the Iran bill. I got to talk about the Iran bill. Speaking of the Israel lobby in America, the Senate overwhelmingly backs Iran talks bill. House overwhelmingly passes Iran deal review bill. Those are the headlines at antiwar.com. Both houses of Congress. But now here's the thing, and I can't remember whether I talked about this on the show or not. I think I did, right? Wasn't it the J.J. Goldberg article in the the Forward yesterday or 2 days ago, where he was saying that, yeah, the lobby's running up the white flag on this thing. They know that they can't beat it. They've got, you know, huge majorities support this bill that gives them the authority to have an up or down vote later on the deal. That's what this bill is. And the president's going to sign it. They failed to get any of the poison pill amendments to it, attached to it. So the president's going to sign it, but it gives the Congress only enough power to pass on an up or down vote within 30 days of the signing of the deal, whether they like it or not and it's working or not. And even if they can pass it, they're not going to be able to pass it. The second bill, I mean, they're not going to be able to pass it over the president's veto, with a veto-proof majority of 2/3, of which is 63 votes. And in fact, the Democrats in the Congress can even stop cloture, which is, if I have it right, all their lingo. I never did memorize all that Robert's Rule of Order crap, but I think the Senate, the Democrats in the Senate, with just a few votes of theirs, can filibuster it, at least technically, and keep it from reaching the Senate floor. So, in other words, the nuclear deal is a done deal, and the AIPAC has basically given up about it, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and all them. So that's good.